While we encourage all of our listeners to think above their age, we understand that the following interview may not be suitable for some of our younger listeners. Parents, you should listen to this one first, and then subscribe, because you'll like the rest of them too. Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Bitch Next Door. My name is Max, and today, my guest is Wednesday Martin. A New York Times bestselling author, Wednesday grew up in Michigan and did her undergraduate work in anthropology at the University of Michigan before going on to Yale University for her PhD in comparative literature and cultural studies. She's published a number of books, including Step Monster, Primates of Park Avenue, and her most recent book, Untrue. Martin has also written for The Atlantic, Harper's Bazaar, The New York Times, The Daily Telegraph, and Psychology Today, among many others. Wednesday, welcome to the podcast.
Max, thank you for having me on.
Oh, please. It's a pleasure. I thought that we would just dive right in. There's kind of so much that I want to talk to you about.
Okay.
And I thought that we'd start with your most recent book, since that's what you're on this book tour for at the moment.
Yes.
And, you know, I was reading this article from a couple months ago that you did in the New York Times, and you told Ruth LaFerla, quote, "My goal is, and always has been, to pursue my interest in topics that inflame people." And that quote just kind of stuck with me in all of the research I was doing on your work. And I'm really curious about why topics that inflame people in particular. And then a second part is, where does Untrue fit into all of that?
Right. Okay. Great question. And, you know, I think what I really meant was my goal has been to pursue my interest in topics regardless of them inflaming people.
I hear that.
And to, you know, persist in picking apart kind of what it is about these topics that make people so upset. So basically, you know, when I look back on it, I kind of just created for myself a career out of considering the lives and realities of the women that we love to hate. So, you know, stepmothers, rich women on the Upper East Side, adulteresses. These are all both, you know, signifiers and actual real people who set our tongues wagging and make our blood pressure go up and sometimes really make us angry. And I think first of all, I was just naturally drawn to these types of women, right, who are sort of renegades and misunderstood, I think, a lot of times when it comes to like stepmothers or adulteresses, misrepresented when it came to wealthy moms on the Upper East Side. And I always just wanted to use my background in anthropology, my interest in primatology, and my familiarity with feminist theory to see if I couldn't kind of reframe these women in a new way and figure out what it is about them that sets us off. And at first I thought I was studying the women themselves, but then I realized that I was also trying to figure out how our reactions to these women told us about our culture and ourselves, if that makes any sense.
It does. And what I find interesting is, you know, in a lot of the interviews that you've done in the past, you talk about how your research came from kind of becoming part of it or ingraining yourself kind of in that society that you're researching in particular.
And yeah, that's anthropology for you.
So do you see it as redemption of some sort? You're on a trying to redeem them in some way?
It might be just trying to get to their subjective experience of being misrepresented.
Right.
What, you know, we think of, for example, when we think of women who refuse sexual exclusivity, that story is usually narrated through the lens of, you know, the person that they supposedly, quote, betrayed, unquote, or through the discourse of moral judgment. But less often are we talking about the subjective experiences of women who are not monogamous, who have affairs, who cheat, or who are openly non-monogamous. We don't talk about it from her point of view. Stepmothers, we have so many narratives about who they are, and so many presumptions, right? And to me, our stepmother business is just straight up gender bias. And nobody seemed to be saying that. And looking at it through a feminist lens, I thought it's weird how all the books for stepmothers are about their stepchildren or about their husbands or their partners with children, and none of them are about the subjective experience of the stepmother herself. And in the same way with Primates of Park Avenue, you know, I mean, people kind of misunderstand that book until they read it. I hear so often from people, say, oh, I thought this book was going to be completely different. You know, they think it's going to be a hate read, or like a send up, like shooting fish in a barrel. And really what I wanted to do was, when I felt so excluded by rich mommies on the Upper East Side,
sure,
and I really wanted to use anthropology to figure out their cultural code, their motivations, you know, why their culture was the way it was, and, you know, figure all that out. So I guess I just like digging into the motivations and culture of women who are misunderstood. And I don't know if it's about redemption. I just want to reframe them and
Absolutely.
I really want to get not just at who these women are, but what does it say about us that we have such strong feelings about them? What are they getting at in us that they set us off so much? What is it that we find so hard to tolerate?
Right. And so I guess kind of widening the lens a little bit, if you'll allow me to kind of lean on your anthropological expertise a little bit more, to ask about this pursuit of personal achievement for women, or this pursuit, I guess, in Primates of Park Avenue about having the Birkin. There's so much talk about the Birkin and your the quest for it, and, you know, the constant preening and all this, and achievement in a woman's own name. And, you know, we've covered so many women on the podcast so far throughout the world and throughout history, and it seems to me that for too many women, they have to sacrifice part of themselves in order to achieve something in their own name. And I was wondering if there's something, if you had any thoughts about what that was about society.
I mean, through the lens of anthropology, every society is really different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's hard to generalize. So, you know, the fates of women in, for example, you know, plow agriculture societies and post-plow agricultural societies, those fates are really different from women who live in places where there was no plow agriculture. So, you know, there are some settings that are really egalitarian, and our, you know, our evolutionary prehistory was about pretty radical egalitarianism. So this idea that women need to sacrifice in order to achieve, in order to have a social voice, a political voice, you know, that's a pretty new development in the human calendar. I mean, until 10 or 12,000 years ago, you know, it was presumed that women were making important contributions and, you know, big achievement, you know, achieving things. So this is a recent state of affairs, right?
Right.
Where women are dependent on men in a lot of the industrialized West, where they're hobbled by, you know, not living with extended families, not being in their kinship network, not having adequate childcare. So in terms of sacrificing, I would just say that, you know, women having less and being less than men is happened a blink of an eye ago, and it's a it's an aberration that I hope we're going to be correcting.
And I hope so too. It's part of the mission here, isn't it?
Yeah,
I thought it was interesting. I read an article, one of your articles, that talked about there was a tribe that where a recently impregnated woman will have sex with multiple men to make them sort of honorary fathers.
Yes, right. Okay. So, right, just diving right into infidelity and how different female infidelity and how different perceptions of it are from mm-hmm. culture to culture. Yeah. So right now you're talking about maybe the Bari or the Canela. Mm-hmm. So there are 17 or 18 different tribes of indigenous people living in the Amazon basin region who have a belief system called partible paternity. Partible paternity is a biological fiction, of course, but it's a belief that a child has many fathers. So a child has the father whose sperm created the baby's head, the father whose sperm created the baby's body.
That's fascinating. Right?
And the father whose sperm created the baby's arms and legs, say. Okay, now the thing is that as soon as a woman knows she's pregnant or maybe before, she has sex with several men. And all these men believe that they're a version of the father, that they are all fathers. There's a primary father, and then there are these kind of secondary or tertiary fathers, too. And all these fathers they believe that they're fathers, and they will look out for the woman while she's pregnant and look out for the child as well. And what's really interesting is that in these cultures, if a woman is monogamous, right, which we consider the best thing for a child outcome and the most important thing in a marker of, you know, maturity.
The nuclear family.
In these partible paternity cultures, a woman who's monogamous is considered selfish and a bad mother.
And it turns out that if a child has more than one father, he or she is markedly more likely to survive to age 16 than a child with only one father. So we see that in certain contexts, female infidelity is what we would consider it, is actually, you know, a really efficacious reproductive and social strategy, so much so that people prefer it and think that monogamy is, you know, a crappy idea.
Sure.
So that was one of the fun things, you know, about writing Untrue. In general, you know, the specific focus of the book is female infidelity. And it was interesting looking at female infidelity in different species. Like I looked at bonobos and, you know, species of birds, where there's presumed monogamy, but the birds aren't really monogamous. I looked at female infidelity in different human cultures, and that was really fun, you know, and instructive. Mm-hmm. But the more general focus of the book is female sexuality more generally, and it's called Untrue, not only because it's a euphemism for a woman who's stepping out, but also because there's just so much in the science and so much in our presumptions about female sexuality that's untrue. So the book really just tries to unveil, you know, a lot of the false presumptions that we've made about female sexuality, and they have become really entrenched.
Can I ask, Primates of Park Avenue was such a big, there was a huge reaction to it, both good and there was, of course, a negative reaction to a certain extent as well. How has it been so far for Untrue?
I think one of the best things about writing a book is when people reach out to you and tell you, you know, that the book somehow nourished them or challenged them or helped them. So with Untrue, it's just been like such an intense reaction, sort of like it was with Step Monster, where I'm telling women who think that they're abnormal, right? Women who struggle with monogamy, and they're convinced that there's something wrong with them, right? Because they've been sold a bill of goods. They're told that monogamy comes more easily to women. They're told that women have lower libidos than men. Now we know from the new research being done mostly by female social scientists and scientists that these things about female sexuality that we've upheld as foundational truths are actually untrue, right? Mm-hmm. So the effect was for these women to feel very unnatural if monogamy was difficult for them. So when you write a book like this, the floodgates really open and people are just so grateful to have been seen through a non-judgmental lens and to have science and social science and data backing up their experience that they're not crazy, that monogamy is hard, that being a stepmother is hard.
Yeah.
So that's been, you know, really gratifying to hear that. With Party Support Cabinet, it was so funny how people had really strong opinions before they read the book. And then when they actually read the book, almost everyone who got in touch with me said, oh, wait, this isn't what I was expecting. They said, Primates Park Avenue has, you know, a lot of social science. And on True, I'm looking at, you know, female sexual strategies. In Primates Park Avenue, I was looking at maternal strategies. And in both cases, I was using anthropology and primatology.
Sure.
But, you know, my goal is always the same. My goal is always to use social science to show us the group of women we might have hostility toward in a new light. You know, so that's been the consistent project.
I want to talk a little bit more personally about you in a second. But first, you know, as a podcast that tells the stories of these amazing women of amazing stories of women from throughout history, I really feel like I can't pass up the opportunity to bring up your book about Marlene Dietrich. And she's such an iconic figure. And I was just wondering, as someone
so
who's
important.
Written an entire and so important, I mean, the pants alone. And I was just.
Hello, the trousers. She was called the best dressed woman in Hollywood.
Amazing.
No, sorry, she was called the best. She was called the best dressed man in Hollywood.
Is that right?
She just was so. She was so confounding to people. Just imagine you're Paramount, right? And it's 1930, and you've brought this starlet over from Germany, and you don't really know that she has this background that in Weimar Berlin she was known as Vati Marlena, right? Like Daddy Marlena.
Uh-huh.
And they invest all this money, they bring her over, they give her a contract, and they've negotiated this deal, and she shows up in Hollywood and she just will not play by the rules, right?
Uh-huh.
She does her first interview and she talks about how she misses her husband and her daughter, and everybody goes crazy and they say, you can't say that, you're a starlet, you're not supposed to be a mom, don't talk about being a mother. And
goodness.
She continued doing that because she said I don't care, like I can be sexy and be a mother, and like that's something women are struggling with in this country still, right?
Absolutely.
So and then you know they her she decided, you know, so then they invite her to some parties, some industry parties, like right to roll her out to show everybody the new property.
Sure.
And she's not having it. She wears trousers. And the studio, the Paramount studio executives, again, just blow a gasket. They can't believe that this woman is refusing to play the game. And so, I wanted to call my book about Marlene Dietrich's subversive stardom because it's really what she did. She just, she came, she saw, she conquered, and she really, you know, just wasn't, she got away with it. I mean, the amazing thing was that she got away with it. The other really interesting thing about her is, you know, she married Rudy Sieber in 1923. And they were married until his death in 1976. And they were very, very deep. They had a very, very deep partnership. But very early in the marriage, she made it clear that she was going to see women, continue seeing women and other men. Wow. And her husband had a long-term girlfriend, a Russian ballerina. And so, you know, she trailblazed open marriage.
Absolutely.
In Hollywood, during, you know, in the 30s.
When the Hays Code was in force.
Yes, and she was in an open marriage, and she never toned it down. And I like to say about her that she deployed candor as a veil. She would go out with Joseph von Sternberg, for example, who directed her in Blue Angel and did some of her best movies with her and figured out how to light her and made her, in a way, you know, helped create her image. You know, they did Morocco together and Shanghai Express and Glenn Moore. Mm-hmm. And she would go out with him and, you know, it was clear that she was with him and she would be affectionate with him. And when the press asked questions, she would, as I said, deploy candor as a kind of veil and say, "What? I have nothing to hide. He's a close family friend. He spends time with me and my husband in our home." And they at times had these almost kind of polyamorous seeming arrangements. Mm. So I think that what few people know about Marlene Dietrich is that she really brought open marriage to Hollywood and a version of female empowerment that Hollywood is still not comfortable with.
Absolutely.
I don't know if people also know. Yeah, she also did this. She had this really cool... there was this group of women in Hollywood in the 30s, like Marlene Dietrich kind of recreated a Weimar sort of decadent lesbian party vibe. And she started this thing that eventually was called the Sewing Circle. And, you know, it was like Marlene Dietrich and like Anita Loos and Claudette Colbert and Dolores Del Rio.
Wow.
Mercedes de Acosta was part of the group. And they, Amelia Earhart joined them, I think. And, you know, they would go to, they would go to gay clubs and, hang out and just, you know, they were sort of a girl posse of lesbians.
I want to hang out with them.
Yeah, I'd love to hang out with them. And when I was writing that book, it felt almost like I was hanging out with Marlene Dietrich. And she's, you know, just somebody who I continue to admire all the things that she achieved and the version of femininity that she put out there that, you know, we still are not living her vision of feminine power, female power, and autonomy. The kind of autonomy that she insisted on having in Hollywood in the 30s and 40s, people are still uncomfortable with women having it. So it really was pretty remarkable what she did.
It kind of reminds me, you know, we do our best on Bitchery not to be political at all. But what it reminds me of is, you know, for so much of American history, our politics has functioned off of shame. And we really don't know how to process it when people, when people's secrets are just out in the open, when they're so, you know, about it. A scandal almost has to be, it has to be about something that's hidden in order for it to be a scandal. And she kind of figured that out so early, it sounds like.
She figured that out. She was so canny with that. She, you know,
amazing.
She figured out that wearing it on her sleeve was the best way to get away with it because people would figure she can't possibly be married and yet have a boyfriend. But there she was. I mean, she was with everybody from Eric Maria Remarque, who wrote All Quiet on the Western Front, to Gary Cooper, to John Wayne. And she conducted these affairs openly. I mean, there were stories about her being out at nightclubs with both of her boyfriends at the same time, while her husband, you know, was out with his partner.
It's amazing.
You know, she went all out.
Amazing. So talking about looking up to her, I was wondering to talk a little bit about you. You know, besides Marlena, what your role models may have been growing up, male or female.
Yeah, I did have some. Margaret Mead was a big one. You know, my mom was really interested in anthropology. And so Margaret Mead books were in our home, Coming of Age in Samoa, Blackberry Winter. And so she was somebody that I looked up to. It was just incredible to me that this thing called anthropology existed and that you could go live in some other place and learn about people by doing what they did. Just was very transporting for me, and being in a small town. So I was a big admirer of Margaret Mead when I was a kid, and Gloria Steinem. My mom was basically like, if you could have been a card-carrying second wave feminist, that would have been my mom. So Gloria was just so glamorous and so smart. She was, she was so dedicated to the cause of what we then called women's liberation. And she just blew my mind when she said things like, a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle. Yeah. Or when she was asked why she wasn't married, and she said, maybe I just don't like to breed in captivity. So she was this wonderful balance of very sort of calm and diplomatic, but her politics were so deeply subversive and fiery. And she had that great 1-2 punch where she had these like racehorse legs and this amazing like sexy hair. But she was a genius. She was, and she really had such deep convictions. So I thought she was incredible. And I also, grew up in an era where, like, people like Florence Kennedy, the activist and, collaborator, really, with Gloria Steinem in articulating second wave feminism. She was Florence Kennedy was somebody I really admired, too. Here was this black woman who was, leading a movement and coming up with all these incredible quips. Florence Kennedy came up with, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem, and a million other things. She also said, I don't understand why just because you need to use the bathroom twice a day doesn't mean you have to live in the bathroom. That's what she said about monogamy and marriage. And it's just so... I would say, like, Florence Kennedy was another person I really admired and thought was amazing. And Shirley Chisholm, of course.
Of course. Like, we've covered her on the podcast.
Wow, that she dared to do that.
Absolutely.
And, I just used to, I remember as a kid just wondering about Shirley Chisholm, where did that self-confidence come from? And I was very inspired by that degree of competence and self-confidence that all those women had. I mean, all those women were remarkably self-confident.
Absolutely.
And that impressed me a lot. That made a big impression on me as a kid.
Can I ask you about another name that popped up a lot in my research, not only that you've written, but also in a lot of the articles that I read about you? Sarah, I'm going to pronounce this incorrectly,
Hurdy.
I think, but Sarah Hurdy? Who's she?
Yes, Sarah Blaffer Hurdy. So Sarah Blaffer Hurdy is one of the people who I learned about when I was older. And she's if there's the contemporary Margaret Mead, but for primatology. I mean, she straddles the spaces between cultural anthropology and evolutionary biology and primatology. She studied Langer's, and she shook up the whole world of primatology and evolutionary biology. When she was a young woman, she went to India, she studied Langer's, and she discovered that female Langer's mate promiscuously. They mate multiply, and they do it as a strategy to ward off infanticide. A male will not attempt to kill a female Langer's offspring if he suspects that he may have sired it.
How interesting. It uses that as a strategy.
Yes. And so Sarah Hurdy came up with this idea in 1977. Her book, The Langer's of Abu, came out. And a few years later, she wrote a book called The Woman That Never Evolved, in which she doubled down on this idea that females of most species were not these doting, retiring, sexually coy, passive beings, but that they were assertive, strategic thinkers driving evolution with their strategizing and with their social and sexual behaviors. So she really turned a lot of science on its head. And so, yes, Sarah Hurdy is someone I admire so much. She's had a big influence on my career and on my thinking. And on, she's also just a beautiful leader. So I really have always turned to her work and her. She's a great comparativist, you know. Mm. She uses the comparative method. She sort of mixes up literary analysis and primatology and anthropology in and looking at contemporary culture to help people understand their behavior in new ways. So I find her really inspiring. And in my thinking and researching about female sexuality, she probably just was more influential in my thinking and writing than anybody else, and has been for many, many years now.
That's amazing. I'm so thankful for you sharing so much with me and with us today. And I have two more questions for you that we ask everyone who comes onto The Bitch Next Door. And the first one, I know that you just had Untrue come out 2 months ago. But the first one is, what comes next?
I've written a novel that is based on all the sex research. You know, in Untrue, I interviewed 31 experts, most of them women, female sex researchers, female primatologists, anthropologists, biologists, sociologists, about female sexuality, all the new cutting edge science about what women like, how we are sexually and why. I, over the years, you know, have been taking that information, and using it to write a novel, a sexy novel, a novel where all the sex scenes are based on what sex research tells us women like. So
sounds amazing.
That'll be coming out. Yeah, that'll be coming out in 2019.
Fantastic.
So that'll be a lot of fun to make the pivot to, you know, writing a novel. And I have some projects to brew in Hollywood, and we'll see what happens with that.
That's fantastic. Maybe when you come out this way, we'll meet in person, and I'll get you on a mic in person.
Yeah, we'll meet in person, and we'll see where everything is.
That'd be amazing. And so the second question is, and I think my favorite question whenever I do this is, do you have any advice that you would give to the world?
I would just say, you know, based on how I've really immersed myself in the data about female sexuality to research Untrue, and I've really been living that for the better part of the last 3 years, I would say have more sex. Enjoy it. We're on our phones all the time. if we're moms, we're thinking about other people all the time. If we're women, we're prioritizing male pleasure all the time. My advice would be for women to have more sex and to be more sexually selfish, to feel more entitled to sex being about what you want as well as what your partner wants. And I would really also advise people to think, if they have the privilege of doing so, to think about, especially women, to feel entitled to have a conversation about whether monogamy is what they want or not. Maybe it is, but maybe it isn't. Hmm. And maybe that changes in a long-term relationship. I think that would be some of my advice, all about sex.
Wednesday Martin. Well, I think that's, we'll just leave it at that. Thank you so much for being on The Bitch Next Door.
Max, thanks for having me on the Bitchery of History. I loved every minute of it.
I will see you next time.
Okay, bye now.
Bye-bye. Untrue. Why nearly everything we believe about women, lust, and infidelity is wrong, and how the new science can set us free, is now available in stores nationwide and online. Hint, make sure you look under the dust jacket. Much thanks, as always, to the team, Allison, Jeanette, Jess, Sydney, and Kim. Many thanks also this week to Carolyn Mosier, and of course, Wednesday Martin. If you'd like to keep in contact with us, make sure you are following us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Just search The Bitchery of History. You'll find us. Make sure you're subscribed to The Bitchery of History on iTunes, Stitcher, Podomatic, Spotify, and I will see you next week. Bye.